Okay, good morning, good to see you all. This morning's Daf HaShavua is sponsored by Bill and Leah Nissel in memory of Leah's mother, Helen Fogel. Is that Henya? Henya bat Mordechai Eliezer, alayha shalom. May Neshama have an Aliyah. Our learning this morning is in her memory. May memory be a blessing. So we turn to Daf Chav Tet. We are two away from the end. And luckily, a thought came to me, maybe in the middle of the night, maybe this morning, I don't remember. But luckily it came to me before we finished this perek. I was struggling a lot with how to align the material of this perek with the rest of the Masechta. We had a lot of details in the first three prakim dealing with rain, providence, loss, and then this last perek felt almost like an add-on. We were talking about the Ma'amad, we were talking about Ne'ilah, we were talking about Duchening, we were talking about Korbanot, and I kind of felt like, okay, we're doing kind of Yerushalayim-centric things, and it kind of struck me, mainly because of an episode that happens in the middle of the Daf today, that we're dealing with different kinds of providential loss through this Masechta. The first perek was seasonal loss. Every year, there's an opportunity for us to feel God's presence with the agricultural system in place. If it rains, God's in our lives. If it doesn't rain, maybe we're in trouble. Now, what year might that happen? Any year. There could be a Bet Mikdash, there could be no Bet Mikdash, I could be in Israel, I could be in Babylon, I could be anywhere. But those kind of seasonal patterns of providence. We then had the second parak was, how did they mark seasonal loss during a different era? When we could go into the street with the Aron Kodesh, and then we got to the third parak, which was about personal loss of providence, dealing with what's called Pirkei Chasidah with some of the pious figures, and we kind of tend to put focus on all those who received providence. They prayed for 2 seconds, and then it started raining. But we say the overwhelming majority of stories were sages who came to the fore, prayed, and nothing happened, and kind of went, oh, that's awkward, I don't know what I'm going to do now. And then when they all cried, it started raining because they realized that they'd lost providence. There was almost mercy on the part of God, like, oh, this is too awkward, I'm just going to rain. But it wasn't because you deserved it. We now come to the third parak. And what strikes me, again, I'll kind of note the moment, it's on the first Amud here, where there seems to be a massive shift, is that we're now talking about not seasonal loss of providence, which could happen every year. And because it can happen every year, it can also be revoked the next year. Every year, maybe it'll be great. And then personal loss, everyone's different. This is now talking about radical loss of providence, historical loss of providence, which of course means the destruction of the temple. We're now talking about entering a new age. Seasonal loss is still possible, but everything is operating on a different level. We don't have the Bet Mikdash. We're not the chosen people. We're not at the center stage of history anymore. How do we cope with this kind of loss? And it's not like I can say, okay, this was a bad season, let's write it off and move on. We're now on a different historical plane where is there any redemption? Or have we been denied? And if we think about the response other faiths had to our diaspora, we spent centuries with the anxiety that we had been replaced. Anxiety that God doesn't like us anymore. How do we cope? We can't just say, oh, it's raining, it's not raining. Meaning, maybe it's raining and you've got a full garden full of food, but you don't have the temple, so what difference does it make? So we're going to see now, this whole perek is trying to deal with the scale of the loss, and that was really the first half of this perek, talking about what the Ma'amad was for. Because the Bet Mikdash was not simply the loss of a building, although if we think about what we talk about on Tisha B'Av, we often focus, oh, it was just a building that was lost, but the people are still here. But that's kind of the conclusion of our meditation. The first thing to note is the loss of the Bet Mikdash was not just a building being burned. It was the whole infrastructure of the nation was shattered, which is what we've been discussing last few Dapim. The Ma'amad, every town had people go to a shul as the Korban was being brought. They would lay in Bereshit because the world is premised on the functioning of the Korbanot. The stuff in the Bet Mikdash, there was songs sung, people went to watch. The whole people was involved. So it wasn't just like a building was burnt. The national manifestation of our culture was decimated. And now we're going to pivot to, okay, how do I cope with that kind of collective, historical, radical loss? And hopefully with that in mind, some of the what might seem pedantic in this daf we can see is an expression of deep anxiety on the sages. And what we're going to see the sages trying to resolve here, how do I contain despair? Because in theory, I mean, I'll ask you a question. On what day in the calendar, in the Jewish year, has something bad happened to Jews? Yeah, Tisha B'Av, and every other day. You know, I actually, when I was in high school, I had a very stern, austere teacher who was like been there for like 80 years. And he would begin every day with something called the Great Book of Jewish History or something. And every day it had like, what happened on this day? Nothing good ever happened. Every day was like, this town was decimated, or this city was persecuted, or this person was killed. It was never like, oh, and it was the Chasam Sofer's birthday. Have a good day. There's nothing hopeful. So how in a world of radical loss do you contain despair? And this we noted last week briefly, and we had during Sudash Lishit last week as well, the GPAT's presentation about Yom HaShoah, and whether you should have a separate day or contain it to Tisha B'Av. And the thrust of this daf, and it seems pedantic, someone's going to say, we're now going to have the five events that took place on Tisha B'Av, and the Gemara is going to say, how do you know that took place on Tisha B'Av? And we're going to spend like 15 lines trying to prove that something happened on Tisha B'Av. And at the end of the day, like, the Gemara doesn't seem to ordinarily care about proving its point. We said it, believe me. But we could see the anxiety here as, I want to contain everything to that day. I want to make sure that there's still room for hope in a world where everything is now defined by loss. So we're going to contain as much as we can. And I think this will come to the fore. You've got the first very, very wide line where the green begins is going to be where a question is asked and is never answered. And it looks like, just on the surface, the Gemara is trying to distract us. There's a question asked and it looks like the Gemara is like, I don't have a good answer for that. I'll give you a story, and you'll get so distracted by the story, you won't notice that we haven't addressed the question. Now, of course, that's my somewhat homiletic reading. Others suggest there's a word missing out of the girsa, the text, but, you know, we've got the text before us, and we'll do what we can with the text before us. So, Chavtet Amud Aleph at the top, we're now dealing with the five events that took place on Tisha B'Av, and hopefully with that introduction, we'll make it through the next 15 lines without falling into despair ourselves. I mean, why are you going through this? Minalam, the first thing we said, the second line, B'tishbav negzor lavaten sholech nusra aretz. On Tishbav, one of the things that happened was it was decreed we wouldn't enter the land of Israel. When did that take place historically? When were we told we were not going to go into the land of Israel? After the spies. So this was after the spies. So now we need to know, the spies came back and everybody broke down on Tishbav. How do I know that was the date? Because that's what we're told. But now we're going to go through, how do we prove it? And now we're going to have to establish the backstory. Because there are certain dates we have in the Torah that are clear. For example, Minalan. How do I know that that decree took place on Tisha B'Av? Dechtiv, it says, V'hi b'chodesh harishon b'shana sheni b'achad l'chodesh. So this is the first month, the second year after having left Egypt. What's the first month? Nisan. So this is Nisan, which day? B'echad l'chodesh. First day of the first month, the second year after leaving Egypt. So they leave Egypt. When do we leave Egypt? We just had a whole holiday about it. The 15th, 14th, 15th of Nisan. It took nearly a year later, 1st of Nisan the next year, the Mishkan was built. How long did it sit there until we made our first move? It's not something I would have known without having looked at this. It says, how long was it there? So the Gemara responds to that verse by saying, Amamar, Mar said, first word on line, Amar. Amamar, Shana Rishona Asa Moshe Ta Mishkan. The first year the Mishkan was made, meaning that whole year it was being made. Shnia Hike Moshe Ta Mishkan. The second year it was built, the Shalach Maraglim, and the spies were sent. Uchtiv, and we know this from a verse, right? He was Shana Hashenit in the second year, Bechodesh Hasheni, in the second month, which is the month we're in right now, Iyar, Be'esrim Bechodesh, on the 20th day, Na Lehalon Mal Mishkan Ha'idot. That's when the cloud first started. So if anybody ever asks you, when did the Jews first move after Har Sinai and building the Mishkan? This is the answer, the 20th of Iyar, which is coming up in a week and a half. That's the first time we ever moved. So now we've got a firm date. The first trip we ever made was on the 20th of Iyar. Okay, so let's keep track of the date. Uchtiv, and then it said, V'yisu mehar Hashem derech shloshet yamim. How long was that first trip? 3 days. So what day are we on now? 23rd of Iyar. Amar Rabchamar Mechanina, Ota Yom Star Mechar Hashem, and Mechanina said that was the day we turned away from Hashem. We started fussing, complaining. So how long did it take us to complain after we started the journey? 3 days, which I say, you know, I've taken kids on a journey. 3 days is pretty good before they start complaining. And it says, and this is when all the mixed multitudes started complaining. We're hungry. Where's the food? Where's the meat? I can't believe this. We're 3 days in. I was expecting 5-star treatment. We don't have it. And then it says, what was God's response to the fussing? We don't have any meat. The response was, oh, you want some meat? Have some meat. And then all the meat came until the psukim literally describe it coming out of their ears. And how long did they sit there eating meat for? Ad chodesh yamim. It was a month. So what day are we on now? We were in 23rd of Iyar. We're now on? It's a month. So 23rd of Sivan. Dahavu lo esrin v'taritzim b'sivan, but we're on the 22nd of Sivan because it was inclusive. So in the same way, Lahavda, when a Shiva, in my head, I always think, oh, it's Wednesday, the Shiva will end on Wednesday. Of course, that's 8 days. A week is the day before. So a month is the day before. So you're on the 22nd of Sivan. And then instantly at that moment, after the month of eating the meat, precisely at that moment, in Bahalotcha, is when Miriam gets into trouble for a conversation with her brother about Moshe. And how long was she stationary for or outside the camp? 7 days. So what day are we on? Davilu Esrin Vitisha B'Sivan. We're now from the 22nd to the 29th of Sivan. So we're keeping track of our day. Chtiv, and it was on that day. So here the Gemara is presuming the Torah's chronology is not always airtight. Sometimes there are weeks that go by between events that are not disclosed. The assumption here is the story is going moment to moment, back to back. So we've got the move for 3 days. Everyone complained. Instantly meat came. A month goes by. As Miriam gossips. 7 days outside the camp. Shlach lach anashim. And Moshe sends the messengers, the spies, as soon as that 7-day period is over. V'tanya, as it was taught, be'ezrin v'tisha b'sivan shlach Moshe meraglim. And you see here the smattering of evidence. The Gemara is almost in a state of intellectual panic here. Well, you could just leave out some of the details, go through the psukim. But every time it says the pasuk, and you should know the sage says this, so we've got a lot of confidence being built. These are accurate dates. Uktiv, and it says, Yeshuv ben Taris, Meketzar ben Yom, and it took 40 days for them to come back. So now let's think about it. We're on the 29th of Sivan, 40 days later. I mean, I assume you know that's where we're ending up. So it turns out that that's actually the day after Tisha B'Av. If how many days in the Jewish month? 29 and a quarter, so 29 or 30. So assuming if it's 29 days, you count 40 days from the 29th of Sivan, you end up on the 10th of Av. So the Gemara says, uh-oh, hani arbam yom nechi had chavu, but we need it to be 1 day shorter than 40. What's the solution? It wasn't a full month. Amrabaya, Tammuz to have a shata. It happens to be that year. Tammuz wasn't 30 days, it was 29 days. It was 30 days, not 29 days. It was longer, so the 40 days doesn't take you to the 10th, it takes you to the 9th. As it says in the verse, that at that appointed time, I broke down my firstborn. And what does appointed time mean? It means Rosh Chodesh, and there was an extra Rosh Chodesh, it was longer. And it's told that on that night, the whole people cried, and this is the kind of one line of this, I think, most are familiar with, or those people are most familiar with. Amar Rabbi Yochanan says, Tisha B'Av Hayamalem, on that night when they were crying on Tisha B'Av, God said to them, Atembechi, Tembechi, Yashel Chinam, you are crying a meaningless cry over nothing. You're crying because you think the land's terrible. It's not. Vani Kovel Lachem, B'Chiyal Adorot, I'm going to establish for you a crying for generations. And that kind of finished up by saying, this is horrific. But kovia lahem means not just I'm going to make this permanent, but I'm also going to make it potentially limited. I'm going to make it on this day. So there's kind of a thrust here again. We're being very specific that one day this horrific thing happened. The Gemara could say, does it matter it happened on Tisha B'Av? That's the day we pick to kind of think about this. But despair happened. We're trying to say despair has to be contained. So that was the first thing. The second thing that happened, and I've tried to alternate the colors, there are 5 things we said. So the yellow we just did is the first thing. Then we've got red, yellow, red. And then you'll see there's another little bit of yellow and then it disappears. So let's do the next. Cherev Habayit Barishona. How do I know that the Bet Mikdash was destroyed, the first one, on Tisha B'Av? Dichtiv, we've got 2 verses that basically give opposing dates. And if I were a biblical critic, I would say these are opposing dates. The text is messy. We don't have an accurate record. I don't know what we're going to do. So the Gemara is going to say, actually, the dissonance between the verses is describing a chronological unfolding. So if I said, what day was the temple destroyed? It's not that clear. The destruction began on one day and it took a few days. So let's begin. Dechtiv, it says in the verse, V'chodesh HaMishi, on the fifth month. B'shiva L'chodesh, on the seventh day. B'shana Tshaya Sreish, Shana L'melech Nebuchadnezzar Melech Bavel, Ba'ad Nebuzaradan Rav Tevachim, Eved Melech Bavel, Yerushalayim, V'yitrofa Beit Hashem. We said that when did Nebuzaradan, the head butcher of Nebuchadnezzar, come and destroy the temple? On the seventh day of the fifth month. The fifth month being Av. So it was on day seven. Uchtiv, but there's a different verse. It says, V'chodesh Chamishi, on the fifth month in Av, Be'asor L'chodesh, on the tenth of the month, on that 19th year of Melech Nebuchadnezzar, Melech Bavel, Nebuzaradan, the head butcher, came and destroyed the temple in Yerushalayim. V'tanya, so the writer said, E'ev Shalomah B'shiva, you can't say it was on the seventh in that pasuk, Shavik Farma B'asuk, because it says in the other pasuk, it happened on the tenth. V'ev Shalomah B'asuk, Shavik Farma B'shiva, and you can't say it was on the tenth, because it says in the other pasuk, it was on the seventh. First word in the line is B'shiva. So what do we do with this distance? Ha'ket said, what can we do? B'shiva nichnas unachrim leheichal, it was on the seventh that the foreigners entered into the temple, v'achlu v'kilkulu, and they were eating and debasing the place, B'shvi Ushmini, on the seventh and the eighth. V'tishi, and on the ninth, Samach L'chashecha, towards the evening. So Tisha B'Av is the ninth. Towards the evening, basically the ninth is nearly done. And that's when they turn around, and Hetzitu Bo'et Ha'orin, they ignite the fire. V'hayadog v'holach chol hayom kulo, and it burned all the way through the next day, onto the tenth. Shnema oilanu kifana hayom, as it says in the verse, so we're kind of saying towards the evening, that's when the horrific stuff happened. Kinaib salay arav, we get toward the evening. And this is why Rabbi Yochanan said, if I were picking when we should commemorate the horrors of Tisha B'Av, of the destruction of the first temple, in Malahayiti Bote Hadar, if I was there, Lo Kavativ, I would not have fixed it, Elabat Siri, but on the 10th day. Because that's when most of the destruction to the temple was done. Now, how do we have any association with the 10th of Av? What do we do or not do? Right, there are leftover things that we tend to mention. Oh, Tisha B'Av's done, get the wine out, get the meat out, get the music on, have a bath, have a shave, and we tend to have a lot of push-off till the next day, at least till the next morning for most things, sometimes a chatzot, because the 10th was a horrific day as well, and this is kind of a leftover from Yochanan's view. But what about the rabbis? They said, no, we're not going to pick day 10, when most of the things were destroyed, we're going to pick day 9, even though it was only for the last hour. Most of the day was not horrific. It was horrific, but it wasn't the most horrific till the 10th. Rabbanan, the Rabbanan say, Adchalta de Puranaita Adifa. We should just mark the beginning, which again seems to be the thrust of the sages. We want to contain this. If you're going to start talking about when the most horrors took place, thinking about the Shoah as a contemporary example, so I'm going to have to sit down and I'm going to have to pour through the damage and try to estimate what's the most appropriate day, which was the largest town that was decimated, which day will most people guess. I don't want to sit and kind of sift through. Obviously, memory and history is important, but if I have to sit there sifting through, marking which is the worst, I'm starting to quantify evil. I'm starting to I won't escape the cloud. So the rabbis say, when it starts, that's when you mark it. And it starts on the 9th, that's when you mark that. So we've now said, how do I know those two things happened on Tisha B'Av? The first was we got decreed not to go into Israel. We established that through the verses. The second was, how do I know the first temple was destroyed? We said we'd established that through two psukim. Uveshnia minalan. And this is a intriguing answer where we're starting to lose our capacity to muster evidence. How do I know the second temple? And this is closer in time to the sages in the first. How do I know the second temple was destroyed on that day on Tisha B'Av? Coincidence? We said last time, what else happened on Tisha B'Av in history that didn't really happen on Tisha B'Av? Or we're not sure. The Jews were expelled from Spain in 1492. Everyone always says that was on Tisha B'Av. My understanding is that that's not clear historically. And that's how we know that Columbus was Jewish, because he left on Tisha B'Av. Why else would he have left on Tisha B'Av? Maybe there were cheap rates on the boats. Who knows? We're now in the yellow. Uveshnia minalan. How do I know the second Bet Mikdash was destroyed on the same day? Tanya, we have a principle. And this is, again, part of this principle that we're trying to contain despair. Megalgalin schut liyom zakai. Said good days tend to have good things. Chova liyom chova. Bad days tend to have bad things. So you want to know how I know the second temple was destroyed on the same day as the first temple? Because the first temple was destroyed on the day the first temple was destroyed, and bad things happen on bad days. At this point, you know, a pure historian might turn around and say, hold on a minute, that's not how history works. That would solve a lot of research if I could just say, oh, that's a bad day, everything happens there. And the Gemara, again, is now going to say, let me tell you about what happened that day. It was terrible. And it almost feels, and again, this is not trying to undermine, this is trying to understand what the Gemara is doing. It's almost like, let me kind of flash a graphic image in front of your mental kind of landscape so that you kind of just say, okay, I'll accept this. Amru, they said. Who said? They. Kshechar Beit HaMikdash B'Shona, when the temple was first destroyed, Otar Yom Erev Tisha B'Av Haya, it was the evening of Tisha B'Av, as we've just said, as opposed to the day before Tisha B'Av. Motzei Shabbat Haya, it was a Sunday. Motzei Shviat Haya, it was the year after the Shemitah. Meaning, so, Shabbos is finished, you're feeling a sense of some ease. Shemitah's finished, you're coming back into the fields. Like, you've got the buds of, this is now going to be a fresh week, a fresh year. We're going to start again. Umishmarta shel Yehoyari of Haita, and it was the shmir of a particular person. We know the record, we know their name. V'halavim hayu omrim shira, and the Levim was singing a song. The temple was functioning, everything was going, and they were singing. And it happened to be what they were singing. Omdim ala duchan, Uma shira hayu omrim. First one line is Uma, the last of the penultimately thin lines. What were they singing? They were singing V'yeshav alehem et onam. Uvratam yatsmitem. God will visit their sin upon them, and in their evil he will cut them down. This is not a pleasant sentiment, but it's part of the Shish. It's actually the Shish al Yom for Wednesday, but they were singing on a Sunday, and there are commentators who suggest there was confusion as to why they were singing it that day. But they were singing this song. This was part of the Shish al Yom. Velohi speaku lomer, and they didn't get to finish the pasuk, which full pasuk reads, "Vayashav alehem et onam." God visits their sin upon them, v'ratam yitzmitem, and will cut them down in their evil. And then it finishes, "Yatzmitem Hashem alakenu." The Lord our God will cut them down, and it's a celebration of God taking down the wicked. But they didn't get to finish the verse. Ad shabo nachim v'kivshim, until foreigners came in. They were singing, and God will strike down the wicked. Boom, and then the temple was destroyed. And you could read this as, and they didn't get to finish the pasuk, and God took them down. Meaning there was such eagerness on the part of God to strike them down, they didn't get to finish the pasuk. Or you can say they didn't really get to say, and God will strike down the wicked. And God didn't want them to say that. You know, to type it with, I'm going to destroy them, as they say, God will strike down the wicked, so I won't let them finish the pasuk. So I don't want to associate too much that horror with what they're saying. But that's what happened. And then what's the last two words? The yellow? And this took place with the second as well. At which point you say, okay, you're just telling me this at this point. How do I know? And if you think that's as far as we go, Nilchada Beta, Beta was captured that day too. How do I know? Gemara. Well, that's tradition. And now this is the issue. Necher Shahir, and the city was plowed over. Jerusalem was plowed over. How do I know? Doesn't even say Gemara, tradition. It just kind of, at this point you can imagine sitting in a conversation, I'm sure we've all had conversations with someone who sees us at some level of authority, a kid, a peer, a friend, a colleague, and they ask you questions thinking, okay, I'm getting near the thin edge of my wisdom here, and at some point you're like, I have to distract them with something, or just say, oh, you know what I was thinking, or, you know, I'm talking to one of my kids and they ask me things that are not really age appropriate, or whether, like Yom HaShoah, how do I talk with 6-year-old about Yom HaShoah? At some point you start, let me tell you a story, and then you kind of, let's patch over some of this until you're older. So the Gemara says, Nechusha Ha'ir, and we have to insert a question mark there. How do I know the city was plowed over on Tisha B'Av? Tanya, it was taught. Kashachar of Tanaz Rufus, Arasha Taheichal, when Tanaz Rufus destroyed the temple, and what you'll kind of notice, because we'll try to put attention to this, that question is never answered, how I know that took place on Tisha B'Av. And this, the next two stories in the green and the red are signaling the massive transition that takes place with the destruction of the temple and how we can still make space for hope. We're going to have the second stories about the scale of the loss. And the first is going to be, where does power now reside? Where is there room for hope? Who's in charge? Who carries the baton in an age when the temple is gone? And I'll give you a clue. Without Kohanim, who's left? The rabbis are left, and this is where the rabbis kind of say, you want to know how we how do we survive in this new age without a temple and an infrastructure? You have spiritual leadership invested in rabbinic, in scholars, and that I should now not point at me, that was just for the sake of the title, but it should reside in scholars rather than priests. Tanya was told, Shachar Tanis Rufus of Rashid Achecha, when Tanis Rufus destroyed the temple, Nigzag Zerah Rabbi Gamliel Lahariga. They said, kill Rabbi Gamliel as well, because he's a scholar and he's a sage, and we need to kind of get rid of all the wisdom. Ba'adon Echad, one master came in, one Roman came, as they were destroying the temple, and they decreed, get rid of Rabbi Gamliel as well. One of the people who was part of that council, who determined Rabbi Gamliel would die, he came to him, for Amar Beit HaMidrash, and he came to the Beit Midrash, and this is going to sound unflattering, but he spoke in code. He wanted to basically have the opportunity to save Rabbi Gamliel. So he walks into the Beit Midrash, and he says, big nose is wanted. Big nose is wanted. At which point you can imagine saying, that's a little anti-Semitic. And let's be honest, you're Roman. I'm not sure why you're saying that. I don't know if that's an American thing or just a British thing, but it's called a Roman nose. Is that also here? Like having a big nose that tend to be associated with Jews, that was called like a Roman nose. I'm not sure why. But either way, Rabbi Gamliel was going to die. He came in, he said, V'ama balachotem mitbakesh, balachotem mitbakesh, the nose owner. It's one to know that Shamar Gamliel, Azal Shamino, Rabbi Gamliel heard that and he thought, I know who he's talking about. They're coming after me. And Rabbi Gamliel went into hiding. Azal Agabe, Betzina, that general who had announced that in the Beit Midrash, went to find Rabbi Gamliel quietly. Amalei, and he said to him, Imatzlina lach maitalila almadati, if I save you, will you guarantee me a place in the world to come? Amalei, and he says, hen. Yes, and here the commentators say, how on earth could Rabbi Gamliel guarantee he's in charge of who gets in and who gets out? Right, so someone said, was pekuach nefesh. He's not saying that I'm in charge. I'm allowed to lie to save my life. But we'll see. Amale, Ishtavali, he says, I know you just said yes, but now Ishtavali, swear to me. At which point, are you allowed to swear to save your life? Yeah, but I guess the Roman felt like, if you swear, that's going to have some sway with the boss upstairs. Ishtavale, so he swore to him, Salakle igra nafalumet. So this Roman consul said, okay, you guarantee? He runs up to the roof, and he dies. He jumps off and dies. How is that helpful? Apparently, the way things used to work in Rome is, the Gemiri, this third word on the line is Gemiri, first is Nafel. Gemiri deki gazu gazarito met chad menayim mevatli zaratayo. If somebody was part of the decree in the Roman consul and one of them died, the whole decree was cancelled and they couldn't reinstitute it. Which is kind of, I imagine, if you don't like a particular decree, that puts a big target on people's backs. And you think maybe that's not the best way to do it. I imagine the Supreme Court is feeling a little bit like that right now. So that seems to be what's going on. Yatzabat called, suddenly a voice came out from the heavens. Va'amra Adam zeh mezuman l'chayilam haba. And it says that this master, mezuman, was invited to the next world. So Rabbi Gamliel seems to have guaranteed it and sworn it, and God seems to have agreed and accepted him in. And that story suggests a few things. And we'll kind of put that against the backdrop of what we're about to read, which is the destruction. This is a tale of survival. Rabbi Gamliel was meant to die. The Beit Mikdash was gone, and he said, the temple's gone, get rid of their scholars too. And Rabbi Gamliel survived. But how does he survive? Does he survive by a miracle? Seems to be the Roman consul gets a miracle in some sense, and Rabbi Gamliel seems to generate a miracle, but it's not on earth. He seems to survive through diplomacy, through wit, through relying on foreign powers and forces and the kindness of those around us. So it seems to be described, we're now operating in a new way. He's not talking to God saying, God save us. He's not going to Davin. He's got a Roman general who decreed his death saying, I can save you if you promise me something. And Rabbi Gamliel says, okay, I'll promise you something and let's see how this goes. This is a new way of survival. This is not providence. At least it's not obvious providence at work. It's relying on resources and other people. Tana Rabbanan, the rabbis thought, so now we've already forgotten that we were asking, how do I know that you plowed the city? The city was plowed on Tisha B'Av. And we've kind of started thinking dramatically about what was at stake. Tana Rabbanan, the rabbis taught, and in case we haven't fully made you forget about that question, the rabbis taught, M'shecharev Beit Rishona, when the temple was destroyed, again, this is not just a building, Nitkabsu Kitot Kitot Shel Pirkei Kehuna, the young Kohanim gathered together. There were groups of young Kohanim on duty at the time. The temple was being destroyed, and they gathered together. Maftechot Heichal bi'adan, and they had the keys to the temple in their hand. And what did they do? Alu lagaga Heichal. They went up to the roof. So you can imagine the siege is closing in. The foreign forces are coming. The temple is being looted. The Kohanim are standing there with the keys to the temple in their hand. They've got nowhere to go. They've got no underground tunnels to escape. They climb up to the roof, and this is it. And they turn to God and they say, Amru lefana, Rabban Shal Olam, Master of the World, Hol Velo Zekin Liot Kisparin Ne'manen, since we have not been worthy to be trustworthy stewards, Yim Avtechot Mesorat Lach, we hand these keys back to you. So what do? In an act of drama, Zarakum Kalpe Mala, they throw the keys up saying, we obviously are not good enough to look after this. Here, take the keys back. And what do you imagine happens? They fall into the fire, would be the logical conclusion. But what actually happens, Yatsta Ke'en Pesisat Yad, a kind of palm of a hand seems to come down, V'kibalta Mehem, and takes it away from them. V'hem Kavsa V'nafla V'tocha Or, and they jump down and they fall into the fire. And this is, of course, a rather dramatic ending, and a miracle is involved, but it is a signal, providence. This is the kind of the last gasp, where the hand comes down and it takes the keys, the signal, I accept your surrender, that you don't feel like you're worthy, and I'll hold on to these, meaning there is some hope that I'll hand it back someday. The keys didn't get thrown up and then fall down, but there's a new era here. So again, we've kind of stopped asking the historical questions at this point. How do you know that the city was plowed onto? Stop asking. If you don't contain this, if you don't say that Tisha B'Av is going to be our day, how on earth are you going to ever breathe hope again? Life is going to be engulfed with pain, and you're never going to have confidence. So I had a good day. Why'd you have a good day? Luck. You had a bad day yesterday, you're going to have a bad day tomorrow. You can never invoke providence, because if providence was really here, I wouldn't just have a good day, I'd have the temple. So how do I cope in an age without that? We're trying to steer. Despair is Tisha B'Av. And now we're going to see that come to the fore again with what follows. Let's just finish this kind of harrowing scene. Vaylein Kon Yeshua Navi, and Isaiah the prophet had an elegy about these young Kohanim who jumped off the roof. Masa Geicha Zayon Malacha Eifo Ki Alit Kulach Legagot Tishua Melea Ir Homiya Kiria Alecha Lalecha Locha Leli Cherif Lamete Milchama. There is a verse that describes human beings running up to a roof, jumping off, and not dying by the sword, and not dying in war, but just dying in despair, which describes these young figures jumping off and landing in the fire and dying. And not only that, last two words, Af Bakadosh Baruch Hu Neman, it even says about God in the scene, Makar Karakir, he fell off the wall, Vashua Lahar, and he screamed out to the mountains, which is read as him also being mournful about what happened. But I think falling off the wall sounds quite similar to he was with them as they kind of jumped down, and associating his pain with our pain, full stop. And you kind of finish at this point, you feel like you've exhausted asking the historical questions. It's like going for, I don't know how many of you have been on a Poland trip, and obviously everybody copes with and deals with tragedy and trauma differently, but it's like walking through Majdanek and then asking particular questions about dates. And I mean, you're just overwhelmed by loss. And it's like, okay, we need to contain this. Full stop. Meshenichnas av matan b'simcha, when av comes, we limit joy. Amri yudabrei derav shmol bar shilat mishmei derav. And now we have the sage who's going to be quoted saying three different things, who is going to be the first voice who seems to say, let's have, what's that song? Have a little joy? That's not the song, I don't think. Say again? Kindness. A little kindness. There's something about
tenderness.
Tenderness. There's probably a lot of songs have a little something. But have a little joy. We can't finish on this note. As we talk about the tractate of providence, we can't be left hopeless. So he says, what do we say? As Av comes, you should limit the simcha, but mishenichnas Adam Marbim Basimcha, and that's by far the more well-known of these two, because we've got songs about it. That only appears here. That was not in the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, Mishenichnas Av Mamatim Basimcha, end of the line, he says, Kach Mishenichnas Adar Marbim Basimcha, says, when Adar comes, we increase the joy. And Amr Papa says, Hilkach by Yisrael, and just as a what is he saying? He's saying, you think Tisha B'Av comes, we should limit the Simcha. But there's still time for hope. There's still times when you should increase the joy. Even in an age when you are without a temple, joy should sometimes increase, and that's going to be around the time of Purim. And of course, Purim is an age when they're in exile, without the temple, and they survive. And that's the time to celebrate as well. Amr Papa Rupapa says, Hilkach by Yisrael de'ilu dina bahadin achri. This means somebody who's got a court case with a non-Jewish neighbor. Lishtamit minei ba'av, try and get away from them during av, during ma'aseh, because that's when you got bad luck. V'limtzi nashi ba'adar, you should find them during adar and say, oh, you know that court case we've been avoiding? Let's do it now, during adar, because debari ma'aseh, because I'm going to have good luck. Now, you should know, the Rambam includes in his Mishneh Torah that you should lower simcha during av, but doesn't mention anything about increasing simcha during adar, and some suggest, perhaps not compellingly, that's because this is all about luck. And the Rambam doesn't believe that we have luck or fate in Muslim the Yisrael. So in terms of going on Adar and finding someone saying, I've got good luck now, come with me, Rambam's not interested. But saying in Av, you should lower the Simcha, some say, well, he agrees, Jews don't have Muzzle, but people who are not Jews, in Muzzle the Yisrael, but there is Muzzle, but Umad Ha'olam, so they've got good luck during Av, so you should avoid them during Av. I think perhaps the Rambam sees this not as anything to do with providence, lowering simcha. It's about the mourning process as you head towards Tisha B'Av. Either way, that's the first statement that we have from Yehuda bar Rei Rav Shmuel bar Shilat. And the second one, first word in the line is Masle, end of the line. Amar Rav Yehuda bar Rei Rav Shmuel bar Shilat. Rav Yehuda said in the name of Shmuel bar Shilat, Mishmei the Rav in the name of Rav. First one line is Masle, and it quotes the Pasuk first. Latet lachem acharit v'tikva. I will give you acharit, some end time v'tikva, and I will give you hope. And if I were to tell you, out of context, there's a verse that says Jews will have hope, what would you say that might refer to, that we're going to have hope? What might we have? Mashiach, or temple rebuilt, something in the future. And Rav Yehuda bar Shila is going to say, calm down. Don't think the only way to have hope in life is to think about some distant reality that's beyond us. He says, Elu, what are these? First of all, the line is derav. Elu dekalim ukli pishtam. What is a dekel? It says date palms and linen clothing. Where are there a lot of date palms? It turns out there are a lot of date palms in Bavel. In fact, the Gemara in Pesachim says Jews were only exiled to Bavel so that they should eat all the dates in the world and study Torah. And the Gemara says, because what do dates do? Dates are sweet and they kind of unleash the juices and you think well and it'll kind of make Torah more rich, which is a way of coping with exile. And here you've got the same figure, Shud Bashilat, who says, celebrate during Adar, saying, you want to know what hope is? Sitting here with this, and you can imagine him sitting just like this with peers in Bavel, thinking about destruction. So you want to know what hope is? Bagels. That's what hope is. We're here, we don't have whatever we need, we don't have everything in the world, but Bagels and Co. are fantastic. And what else is good? Is, I don't know if that's Dunkin' or if that's coffee from them too. Coffee is great. And the fact that we're sitting here and I'm wearing clothes. So don't think, you know, we don't have providence in our life. Just look at what you've got. So that's what he seems to be injecting here again. After we've heard about the loss of the temple and the scale, the ma'amadot are done. So what's my hope? That someday maybe this will get rebuilt, something unimaginable to me. So unimaginable that one way that we've come to terms with this is imagining it's going to fall down from the heavens. I can't, you know, we're never going to build it. It's going to have to come down. God's going to have to build it. It's so distant and remote. As he says, it doesn't have to be distant. It's right here in the clothes that you're wearing and in the food that you're eating. V'yomer, and there's another pasuk here. So the first one line is derav, and this is a pasuk taken from Genesis, from Bereshit, when Yaakov enters into his father's presence, dressed up as his brother. Yitzchak is blind, and he goes, I smell something as he comes in. And actually, it's a scene that is suffused with the senses. We tend to just remember the line, Hakol kol Yaakov yidam de'etav, I hear your voice. But he feels him, and he gets confused about the touch. He hears him, kol kol Yaakov, he tastes the food, he can't see, and then he smells something. And it says, what does he smell? V'yoma re'i re'ach b'ni, k'rech sadeh, asher baruch hu Hashem, the smell of my son is like the smell of the field. Now, is that a good thing or a bad thing in this context? Yeah, meaning Esav is an ish sadeh, so presumably, oh, you smell like Esav, which I don't know how Esav smelled, but it's like, presumably he was a hunter and he didn't bathe very frequently. He says, oh, you smell like the field. But that's not what Rabbi Yehuda bar Rei Rav Shmuel bar Shilat says. Mishmei Rav says, you want to know what that smell was? It's Asher Baruch Hu Hashem, which God blesses. You want to know the smell that God blesses? Karech sadeh shel tepuchim, like a field of tepuchim. What is a tepuach? We call it an apple now. What does apple originally mean? Anybody know? What did it designate when the term was first used? It just meant fruit generally. It didn't mean like the apple that we have, which is why there was some confusion in the Christian traditions that the fruit in the Garden of Eden was an apple, which there are no sources earlier really than the medieval church fathers that say that. because when it said apple, it just meant fruit. And in the rabbinic context, there were like 14 different possibilities. Some suggest it was a pomegranate, some say it was an etrog, some say it was wheat, grapes. Nobody says it was the apple that we have. I don't know what the apple was called, like as a distinct fruit. You've got Tosfot here, the third line says, Yesh mefarshim tepuchim korech etrogim. Some say tapuach also means an etrog in this context. And this is, I'm going to have to be somewhat inventive here. All the commentaries say these are just three disconnected statements, and we're quoting Rabbi Yehuda Shilat, so we'll quote three things. We're trying to weave together a theme here that he's trying to say we can have hope in exile. So let's assume that there were lots of tepuchim where he was living in Bavan. He says, you want to know what God blesses? Sadash al tepuchim. Look outside. We've got etrogim. We've got whatever fruit's being described. They're all around us. You want to know what the smell of God is? Just walk outside and breathe in. And that's why this is pertinent here, because he said other things too. Why just quote three things? Presumably there's a theme. Full stop. We're now going to transition into some halachic questions that came up in the Mishnah, but we're going to have the same emphasis on trying to contain despair to a particular moment without kind of grazing over the loss. We're going to talk about how terrible it was. Young Kohanim jumped off the roof, but we can't become too absorbed in that, otherwise we'll lose our footing. So the Mishnah said, "Shabbat shachal Tishba av liyot betocha asur lesaper lechabsan." The Mishnah said the week on which Tishba B'av falls, you can't have a haircut and you can't launder clothing. So I'll ask you a question: Tishba B'av falls on a Wednesday. It says the week it falls, I can't have a haircut. When would you say if it falls on a Wednesday, I can't have my haircut? Just on the basis of the Mishnah. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. That's what you would say based on the Mishnah. Oh, and Saturday. It says the week it falls, you can't do it. What would another reading be? That's one reading. Sunday. You say it falls on that week, so I can't do from that week Sunday to Shabbos. You might think Sunday through Friday, I can't. It says the week it falls, I can't do anything. So those are going to be the two readings. Which one would you say, now that we've introduced both, is like the more grounded reading of what it says in the Mishnah? It says the week Tisha B'av falls, you can't do these things. I'd say the... Right, I'd say probably Jay's is kind of more inflected by how we behave than just the text of the Mishnah. And we're going to have to assert to end up where we end up, to say, no, it only means before Tishba. We cannot become, we can't let this leave that time, otherwise it will infect the rest of our lives. Amar Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman says, Lo Shana, we're going to get to that in a minute. The first question is, what kind of launder? It says you can't launder things. Now, ordinarily, why do I launder things? Not money. Yeah, go on, why do I launder things? For what purpose? To wear them. For my sins, I tend not to do laundry. It's still to the point where actually I would need to be told how the machine works. But I was told once because I felt bad not knowing it, but I haven't used it since I was told, so I have no idea. But I tend not to do laundry. But I also wouldn't do laundry for fun. I would do it because I need the clothing. Or somebody needs the clothing. But again, the strict textual reading of the Mishnah would be, don't do laundry that week. Sounds like you enjoy cleaning things, you're never going to wear it in your life. No cleaning. It's nothing to do with wearing, nothing to do with function. This is to do with cleaning. And we'll see where we'll fall on that question. And these two questions, the literal reading of the Mishnah, where it says, don't clean the week of Tisha B'Av. The strict reading of both would be, don't clean anything for any purpose the whole week. The lenient reading would be, don't clean what you need during those few days. And we're going to fall down differently on those questions. So, Amr ibn Nachman, Lashon, Lechabis Livvash, El Lechabis Lanich Matar. Rav Nachman, we're going to have a debate with Nachman. Rav Sheshet, Rav Nachman says, you can wash things as long as you're not wearing them. It's just saying you can't wash and wear clean clothes. Rav Sheshet, Amar Afil Lechabis Lanich. Rav Sheshet, no, even laundering clothing that you're not going to wear is a problem. Now, why would it be a problem? I understand wearing clean clothes might be a problem because it's a time of mourning. Why would just laundering things, which kind of come back to Michael's original answer when I said, why do you launder things? And he just said, because of the dirt. Why would it be laundering things if you're not going to wear them be a problem? Why would that be a breach of... So it could be technically that people might think you're going to wear them.
It's a hopeful thing to do.
Right, you're trying to clean things up. Even if you're not going to wear it, meaning you're going to walk around the world, I don't like dirt. I want things to feel smooth. And Tisha B'Av that week, we're not trying to glaze over the horror. We're trying to say, you know what? There is dirt here. There are stains in our life. And Rosh Hashanah is the stricter view here. And it seems to be during that week, or during that few days, don't even clean things. Amar Rav Shesh says, Teda, and you should know this, he says, Depatli Kitzri Debei Rav, because the launderers of the house of Rav would stop during this time. Even things weren't being wore. They would just, process and clean things. You shouldn't clean anything that week. Mesiv, and we're now going to have some back and forth. How do we know who's right? Mesiv, there's a question asked from Nuna said, there is a brighter that says, B'chamishim utarim nei kavod ha-shavah. What did the Mishnah say? The Mishnah said, you can clean clothes on Thursday for the sake of Shabbos. So what are you doing presumably on Thursday to the clothing? You're washing them. Are you wearing them? No, you're doing it for Shabbos. So he's saying you can do it on Thursday without wearing them because of Shabbos. So it sounds like you can't do it without wearing them any other day. Lamai, what are you talking about? Ilay melechabes elvash. Are we talking about cleaning and wearing them? My covered Shabbos. What is that going to do with Shabbos? That's just you cleaning and wearing it on Thursday. Elalahaniach. It must be saying on Thursday you can launder clothes and leave it for Shabbos. V'chamishu d'shari avala Shabbat kulasa. And that's only on Thursday, but no other day. So it sounds like Rav Sheshes is right. You can't do any cleaning at all, even if you're leaving it over, apart from on Thursday. La'ulam, answer would be, no, really, you are allowed to launder and leave over. You're not allowed to launder and wear. But on Thursday, if you've only got one cloak or one piece of clothing, you can launder it and wear it again on Thursday if you're not going to have time to do it on Friday. As we have said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, if you've only got one top, one cloak, muta lechabse b'chol shemod, you can wash in chol shemod, same to here. It manami, we've also got it taught elsewhere, Rabbi Yamin, Rabbi Lazar, l'shenu lechabse l'vosh, ever l'anech mutar, but hold on, we've also got a question here that says putting it down is okay in the name of Rabbi Yamin, Rabbi Lazar. So it sounds like Rav Nachman's about to win this. Rav Nachman has said you can wash as long as you're not wearing. We had a question, we kind of batted that away. We've even got a rabbinic statement from someone else who says you can wash it as long as you're not wearing it. Meitfei, and here's going to be the fatal pushback, where we've got a straightforward brighter that says it out loud. Asur lechabes lefnei Tisha B'Av. You cannot wash clothing before Tisha B'Av. Afilu lahaniach la'achat Tisha B'Av. Even if you're just putting aside for after Tisha B'Av. V'geyut shalanu kikibu shalahem. And we should just note, geyuts is a form of cloth pressing. So it's cloth pressing that was done in Israel. Geyut shalanu, the cloth pressing that we have, kikibu shalahem, is like their laundering, meaning putting it in the washing machine isn't what they're talking about. They're talking about going to like a dry cleaner. So you shouldn't dry clean. But washing machine's okay, that's okay. Seems to, meaning in terms of a metaphor. Klipishtan Embe Mishum Gets, and there are certain clothing which can't be pressed anyway, so it's kind of limiting. In the, what does everybody know you can clean during the 9 days? You can launder. You can put in the washing machine. Undergarments, basically. There are limits to this to make life livable, and it's kind of rooted in this. There are some clothing that we're not saying you can't wash because you need to wash some clothing. But we've now dispensed with the view of Rav Nachman. Rav Sheshes rules you cannot clean clothes even if you're not going to wear them during the 9 days, except for underwear and things like that. Kids' clothing as well. Shalach Bar Yitzchak, and now we've got yellow, we've got a side point, and then we're going to turn to the red, which will be a rather swift few lines. Shalach Rabbi Yitzchak Bagira Mishmeid Rabbi Yochanan. We have a statement in the name of Rabbi Yochanan. Afa Pisham Mikli Pishon Eimba Mishem Geitz. Even though they said these linen things, you can't really press it. Don't worry about it. Aval Asul Lav Shem B'Shabbos Shachal Tishba V'Diyot B'Tochatz. So you can wash them, but you shouldn't wear them. So there is some room to clean some things if you're not going to use them. Full stop. Now we have a debate between Rav and Shmuel that we insinuated earlier about what about after Tisha B'Av. It says the week of Tisha B'Av. So do they include the days after as well? Rav says, Lashanu el lefanav alachor of mutar. If Tisha B'Av is on a Wednesday, you can do all these things on Thursday and Friday. That's a view of Rav. Shmuel amar afilu la'achor of namei asur. Shmuel says, what are you talking about? This is horrific. This is like saying, you know, Yom HaShoah ends. That night, I'm going to have a big party and drink. So like, give it some time. Let it sit. But Rav seems to say, no, once it's done, it's done. Meitfei, we're now going to go back and forth to suggest who is right. Last word on the line is Meitfei, first word of the next line is Shabbat. Meitfei, we have a brighter. Shabbat shachal tishbav liyot b'tocha. In the week that tishbav falls, asur l'saper l'chabes. You cannot wash and get a haircut the week that it falls. V'chamishi mutarim imnei kavod ha-shabbat. And on Thursday, you can for the sake of Shabbat. That's what the Mishnah said. But the brighter goes further and says, let me explain to you how this would work. Ketzad. Chal liyot be'echad b'shabbat. If Tishba fell on Sunday, mutar l'chabes kol ha-shabbat kula, You can wash and launder the whole week, meaning it falls on Sunday. We said the week it falls, you can't do anything, but if it falls on Sunday, you can do everything the whole week. That doesn't sound like the whole week you can't do, so we're about to set this up. If it falls on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday, you can't do anything before, but afterwards you can. We've already proven the point in the Braita, but we're going to quote the whole Braita. If it falls on a Friday, you can do laundering on the Thursday for the sake of Shabbos. By the way, if you didn't get to do it on the Thursday, meaning if you can do it on Thursday for covered Shabbos, let's say I couldn't make it on Thursday. I couldn't get to the laundry, whatever it was. Am I only allowed to do laundry on Thursday for covered Shabbos, or does that covered Shabbos let me do it on Friday as well? Meaning, when is Tisha B'Av? Tisha B'Av is on the Friday. We said you can do it on Thursday for covered Shabbos. Let's say I didn't get to it on Thursday. Shabbos is still coming. So the Braita goes on to say, Vim lo kabas bechamishi, if you didn't get a chance to launder it on Thursday, first of all, the line is b'Shabbat. B'Shabbat, mutar lachabes be'erev Shabbat min amechal amala. You can do the laundry on Friday afternoon, as Shabbos is coming, Tisha B'Av afternoon. And now we've just got in the pink a little reaction here in the middle of the Braita. Light ale abayvid mirach bayagavaha. You should just know that Abay cursed people who did this. In brackets, let's move on. Meaning, you're allowed to clean things on Tisha B'Av afternoon on a Friday if you need to, but Abay is saying, you know, that's not good. You know, this is Tisha B'Av. You can do it, and we're trying to contain despair as much as possible, but recognize the day. We've said you can't clean things even if it's not going to be worn, and you shouldn't really be doing this. He says, but if you need to, you need to. And if somebody does come to you, you know, that somebody with nothing to wear for Shabbos, say, I need to clean clothes, and it's Friday afternoon, the advice would not be, you can, but this is cursed. You know, yes, you can. But have in mind, you know, try not to do this in your head. You'd see, you know, I'd remind them another time not to. The Braita continues a couple of lines. Chaliyah b'shen v'chamishi, if it falls on Monday or Thursday, Karen Shoshim after Echad, you have three aliyot to the Torah and a maftia like you would regularly. B'shish v'rivi, it was on the Tuesday or Wednesday, Karen Echad, maftia Echad, you don't have one aliyah and one and someone doing the Haftarah. Rabbi Yossi, Amal Olam, Karen Shoshim after Echad, and Rabbi Yossi says, no, you always do three aliyot and a maftia. Shifta to Shmuel, either way, this seems to push back on Shmuel, who said, after Tisha B'Av, you can't do things either. We've established, the Braita says, only before Tisha B'Av, the problem, afterwards, you have to move into a kind of reign of hope. So Shmuel's done. Amlacha Shmuel, Tanaihi. Shmuel would say, no, it is a debate among the Tanaim. Detanya, first one line is Detanya, it's seven lines, eight lines up. And we're now going to have a Braita with three different views, one of which suggests, I mean, if you were trying to decree how to react to the loss of what happened on Tisha B'Av, how long would you say it would be worth commemorating the loss? Say, the temple's gone, everything's destroyed, and you're sitting around in a room like this, there's no record of Tisha B'Av, 3 weeks, 9 days, trying to figure out how do I commemorate this loss? How much time would you say it's reasonable to give to think about the loss? Some might say give it a minute. Some might say we should never forget about this. And in fact, there are ways in which some suggest we think about this all the time. We tend not to see this in the diaspora. In Israel, you see it a lot, that people leave in their homes, like a square undecorated on the wall. And I thought about when we moved in and we're getting painting done, should we do that? And then I forgot, and that didn't I didn't mention it to anybody. But nobody seems to do that here. We've got a kind of permanent reminder we're not in Israel, because we're not in Israel. But there are ways that this bleeds into it. How long would you say is reasonable to think about this? I mean, you don't have to answer. That's what's going to be coming up in this Braita with these figures. And there are three different views. And Shmuel and Rav are still playing through these views. And Shmuel says, you think I'm crazy. I'm just repeating to you a view that had a currency in the previous generation. I'm saying, and I'm not even the craziest, I'm just saying that whole week that Tisha B'Av falls from Sunday to Friday, you should be avoiding things. And Shmuel is saying, and Rav is saying, no, till Tisha B'Av, and that's it. So, Tanai, to Tanya, eight lines up, first one line. Tanya was taught in a Braita. Tisha B'Av shechaliyo b'Shabbat. If Tisha B'Av falls on a Shabbos, v'chein ev Tisha B'Av shechaliyo b'Shabbat, or if it's a Tisha B'Av falls on a Sunday, meaning Shabbos is going straight into Tisha B'Av, so you'd imagine I should signal Tisha B'Av is coming in some way, but no. Ochel v'shote kol tzarcha. You should eat as much as you want on that Shabbos. And mala shulchanam afilig sil shloma b'sha'ato. She even put on the kind of lavish feast that Solomon would have had in his heyday. Meaning Shabbos is Shabbos. You are insulated from the 9 days. You are insulated from the week of Tisha B'Av. Doesn't matter if it is the ninth of Av and it's pushed off to the next day. If that's what if it's Shabbos, you have festive eating. There's no sudum of seket. It's Shabbos. But now we have, but it is prohibited to have a haircut or to launder from Rosh Chodesh v'ad hatanet, from the beginning, from Rosh Chodesh until the end of the fast. That's the view of Reb Meir. And we have the 9 days, which in some ways are modeled on this, but it's more lenient than you have the week of Tisha B'Av itself. But he says everything should be prohibited from Rosh Chodesh. Who, Paskins, by the way, who holds of the 9 days? Let's put it differently. Who doesn't hold of the 9 days? Yeah, they're below us sometimes, I think. Yes, the Sephardim don't do 9 days. They do the week of Tisha B'Av. We, kind of as Ashkenazim, obviously Sephardi and Ashkenazi history has been traumatic in different ways, but we were kind of pummeled for centuries in kind of more extreme ways. And we have been wont to add mournful practices. And we have the whole of the 9 days. And this happens to be the view of Meir generally. Rabbi Yehuda says, Kol HaChodesh Kulo Aso. You want to know how long you should think about it? You want to know how big this loss was? The whole of Av. This tends to be how things work in America. You have like Memorial Day and you've got Thanksgiving. If you want people to pay attention, you do 1 day. If you want to make a big sign but no one's going to pay any attention, what do? Yeah, Black History Month or Jewish History Month. What does that mean? All right, there's a proclamation somewhere. I don't know what that means. So again, how do you make this meaningful? How do you recognize the scale without making it background noise? And here, Rabbi Yehuda said, you want to know the whole month of Av, you shouldn't be doing anything. And Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says, no, it's only that week. So it seems Rabbi Shimon Gamliel has the most limited view. So what Shmuel is saying, it's a debate between the early sages about how much time we give. Don't tell me I'm crazy and bring a brighter. I'll bring you a brighter. Second line up, I'm Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan says, and you want to know how difficult this is to adjudicate. It's not like they're drawing from different places. They're all picking on one verse. Dichtiv, as it says, Vahishavti, and I will take from them, kol mesosah, all their joy. Chaga, chadasha, vishavta. I will take their festivals, I will take their months, I will take their weeks. Manda amar Rosh Chodesh v'atanet, the view that says the mournful practice should be from the beginning of Rosh Chodesh till the Tanet, which word do they focus on? They focus on the word Chagah, I'll take your festival, meaning Rosh Chodesh is a kind of festival. Now over onto the next page roll. And we'll finish. Manda amar kol HaChodesh kol, the one who says that the whole month should be mourned, Asa mechadash, Asur mechadasha, they take it from the word, I will take their months. The whole month should be recognized. Manda makol Shabbat kula, so, and the person who says only that week itself should takes it mishabata from the word shabata, full stop. And then we'll just have the bottom line. Amrav halacha k'rab Shuma Gamlin, Amrava halacha k'rab Meir. And Rava confusingly says, the halacha follows Rav Meir and Rav Shuma Gamlin. Which you think, which one? V'tarvayu l'kula, but both of them to leniency. And you need to say both, because what was the view? The view of Reb Meir was from Rosh Chodesh till Tisha B'Av, and the view of Gamliel was that whole week. So he's now going to say, and we go leniently on both. If you would have told me you follow Reb Meir, have I been from Rosh Chodesh? You would have thought, oh, from Rosh Chodesh to Tisha B'Av, Kamash Malan, Halacha Reb Shimon Gamliel. So it says, no, just that week. If you would have said it was Reb Shimon Gamliel, have I been from Rosh Chodesh? I would have thought, oh, afterwards as well. Kamash Malan, Halacha Reb Meir, so we told Halacha is following Reb Meir, that week only and only before Tisha B'Av, full stop. So we've got one verse, we've got the same history, we don't know how to react to this, where do we put our emphasis, and the bottom line thrust seems to be from the sages, the way we cope with this loss is containing it as much as possible, but in that zone where it's contained, it is extreme. You can't wash things, even if you're not going to wear them. You're not eating, you're not shaving, you can't do anything those few days, but keep it there. And then you've got to live your life. And you've got to find a way to have hope. Recognize that what we have is signal of providence at some level. And then we're going to pivot forward for the last daf, basically, next week. And we'll try. That's why I try to go over a little bit this week. So next week, we'll go over a little bit as well. And then we'll leave a few lines. And then Shabbat, Erev Shavuot, I hope as many of you can be here as possible and aren't away. we'll do Siyaman Shabbat morning, and instead of the drasha, I'll kind of finish off the Masecha and invite everybody who's comfortable, who participated, to stand up at that time. We'll kind of do a Siyam for everybody to recognize our learning and bring it to a close. So I thank you all. And I wish you a wonderful week. Chanan Nakash with the Chalish Bakal is a good idea. Do a Lavika Chim to Mitzvot Shneimad and Aicha Faith the Mansid Ko Yagdil Torah Viyadir.